Cooking and eating insects is nothing new, but it's a squeamish idea, at least in Western culture. Sustainability, animal welfare, deforestation, food insecurity, malnutrition, even overnutrition, no matter what way you approach it, the case for eating bugs is strong. So why aren't we eating them, at least in this part of the world? Really, it all comes down to cultural taboos. Now, with the support of Air Serenbe, Serenbe's Artist in Residence program, graphic artist Blue Delaquanti is working on a new graphic novel addressing those taboos. Producer Aaron Wright spoke with Blue alongside Chelsea Thomas. Chelsea heads the amphibian conservation program at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, where she grows insects for the frogs in her care. Aaron asked Chelsea why we should be eating these insects too.
Yeah, there are a lot of different reasons why we should bother. There's just fun. There's 2,000 new flavors for us to play with, textures for us to play with in cooking, and we're always looking for some new ingredient. But beyond fun, there's the environmental impact. We have a lot of the current deforestation coming directly from the meat industry. We have a lot of the current global greenhouse gases and ammonia emissions, acidification of the soil. We're doing a lot of harm with the meat industry, and that is very much not the case with the insects. We have a lot less of those factors. They are easily grown vertically, close together, right near us locally. And then there are also social factors where the UN FAO is actually pretty excited about this idea. In 2013, they released this long report, and one of the things they were saying there is that it can really help a lot of countries where they cannot be in charge of their own meat production, and so those communities will always be reliant on outsiders. And so with insects, they could gain a lot more power over their own fate.
Yeah, to be honest, raising insects requires an extremely low bar for time, money, investment, and expertise. Literally anyone can set up a mealworm, like, bucket or, like, series of drawers, like a box to raise crickets. You can do it in a garage or a spare room, and it requires very little, extra knowledge or time or money. And that can be really important, as Chelsea says, when you don't have a lot of food security or just don't have a lot of control over, you know, the ethics of your food. Chelsea told me something really, you know, disquieting the other day, where if we were to make any more land available for rearing cows, it would pretty much all cut into rainforest, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's just nothing else left to give other than deforestation. Insects, on the other hand, are extremely prolific. They're very easy to breed. The time frame for breeding them is very short and very, frankly, pretty forgiving. If we are able to figure out how to make them not only accessible but enticing cuisine offerings, you know, to catch up with most cultures around the world, that would make a huge step towards a more sustainable global food culture.
Absolutely. And there's one more factor I'd like to bring in as well, which is our safety as far as antibiotic use, because some people feel afraid of the idea of eating insects and are worried that that might make them sick. But in reality, insects are very unlikely to make you sick. They have very different bodies from ours. They're cold-blooded, and they don't even have blood. They have hemolymph, a very different liquid. They're not going to be carrying bloodborne pathogens. They're not going to be carrying most of the same bacteria, other than the exceptions like mosquitoes or ticks. So when we farm them, we aren't going to need to give them antibiotics, which means we're not going to create versions of the same bacteria that live in our bodies that don't respond to medicine. And that's what's happening in a lot of our meat.
Could you talk about, what is the nutritional value of insects? Is it comparable to eating a piece of steak or pork?
The nutritional values actually vary widely among insects. That's part of what's so great about them, because the world doesn't need one solution. It needs a variety of solutions to many different problems. So the largest problem worldwide is anemia, lack of iron and B12. And a lot of insects are extremely high in those two nutrients in particular. But we also need different things even here in America. There are areas where we need foods that are higher in protein with fewer calories and less fat. And there are areas where we need more of our minerals, calcium, and especially the good fats, the omega oils. So some of the insects, like waxworms and mealworms, are very high in fat, but they are primarily the omega 3, 6, and 9 in really great ratios, so that fat isn't necessarily bad.
They're the kinds that they talk about fish having, fish oil. They're the ones that they always say you should try and get more of if you can.
Do we know why insects are not a part of the Western diet?
There is a theory I have read that, you know, obviously there's a bunch of different variables, I'm sure. One of the theories I've heard is that because European climate is generally colder, insects don't grow as large. You know, they aren't as competitive as a food source as opposed to, say, larger, you know, chattel animals. And when European colonists started settling, you know, what would become the United States, they did not have that interest in raising insects for food. And you see that in texts of colonists moving across the West and meeting with lots of Native American cultures who would collect insects that occurred naturally, a lot of them in clouds over the Midwest area, and not really sure what they were doing or why, but that it was probably bad somehow. But that is a theory that I've heard that holds water with me, but I'm sure there's, you know, a bunch of variables.
Why are crickets the gateway bug?
A lot of companies have made the argument that people have more positive connotations in the West with crickets than with most insects. We have our Jiminy Cricket type image. Mm. We have a positive connotation with the song as well. We hear that during the summer. We're very aware that they're around us, and so it doesn't seem strange. They also have some of the better nutritional profiles. We have a lot of calcium, a lot of protein. So it's easy to make an argument for crickets, but I do want us not to forget that they're only one option, and that if you don't love the taste of cricket, there are a lot of other things. I personally am not a huge fan of crickets, but I am a huge fan of mealworms.
Mm-hmm. What do crickets taste like?
They're a little crunchier, and they kind of have a nutty, like a party mix kind of flavor profile.
Chex Mix, party mix.
Exactly. Yeah, we've had them with like sea salt and kind of like barbecue chip flavor. And mealworms, because they tend to be a little fatter and can absorb more of like the oil and things that they're cooked in, they tend to be a little more versatile and a little more like almost meaty. Or they seem that way more when they're, you know, in your mouth and you're enjoying them.
Mm. They have a sort of pine nut type flavor as what I usually consider their first flavor. So I like to use them like in a pesto.
Mealworms,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they also take on a lot of flavor from what you feed them, which is why I like to gut load them. If I feed them a certain food for a couple days or even just one day before we put them in the freezer and then the oven, then they're basically a little tube of meat around a little string of cinnamon, a little string of oregano, whatever flavor you want to put in there.
Mm-hmm. Pretty interesting. How do you prepare a mealworm pesto?
Well, you would take your mealworms and put them in the freezer. If you're not sure where they came from, they might have parasites. It's probably a good idea to blanch them for a few seconds in boiling water. Then you're going to put them on a tray in the oven at about 200 degrees for about an hour. Then you can grind them up a little bit in a mortar and pestle and put them in instead of pine nuts or in addition to pine nuts in a regular pesto recipe. It's really good.
Now, I can imagine some people getting squeamish at the thought of, you know, blanching mealworms and then roasting them for an hour. But I've read that we're actually already eating insects every day, every one of us.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
There is an extremely common red dye that is made from an insect known as cochineal. It's a New World insect that has been used since, what, the last few hundred years?
Is that really, really tiny red bug?
That's right.
Yep, that's right. And is used in everything from lipstick to cherry Coke. Like, it's very common. It's a harmless additive. It was until fairly recently in a very classy Italian liqueur known for its red color named Campari. Mm-hmm. Am I remembering it correctly? But also, you know, less intentionally, there are FDA-regulated limits for insect and insect parts in food such as peanut butter, things that where insects will kind of occur during the harvesting process of whatever the materials are for that food.
So they're not added in. It's part of the agriculture process that there are.
Precisely. Yeah. Like in cinnamon sticks, you know, it's hard to be able to extract every possible hitchhiker from the cinnamon sticks you harvest. So it comes with the territory.
Exactly. That's one of the highest ones. Or tomato sauce. They don't make tomato sauce out of tomatoes that you would buy at the store. So almost everyone they make it out of is going to have some larva inside of it.
Mm-hmm. The less photogenic ones.
And chocolate?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yep. Anything that, you know, will have regular pollinators or just insects as part of the local ecosystem, there will always be some stragglers in
there. And insects are a part of every local ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They outweigh us and outnumber us by far. Blue, how are you introduced to the concept of eating insects?
It occurred on a trip to Thailand that I took while I was in college. We were staying in a relatively rural area, and one night the community decided to host this cricket collecting dinner where you go out into the field. They've set up a UV light, a piece of aluminum siding, and a big ceramic jug, and all of the insects will collect to the light, and then they'll land, you know, around the area. So you collect them, you fry them, eat them with rice and vegetables, and it was delicious. And for a long time, I thought that was it. I maintained what I thought was an extremely casual interest in insect eating.
Oh, it's not so casual anymore.
No. That was, as soon as I realized how much information I would, you know, seek out without a lot of external pressure, I realized that I was genuinely interested in the subject, and I found that it would be a really interesting story to tell in my personal medium of comics. I found that comics is a really accessible medium for making subjects that, you know, people might find kind of bizarre or esoteric accessible and easy to understand, especially when it comes to topics like food.
Could you actually tell us a bit more about this? You're working on a graphic novel. It's called Meal. You've already been through one residency at Serenbe, and you're going through your second residency with Serenbe right now. Both of these times you're working on this graphic novel called Meal. Can you tell us the story of, like, the actual story of the graphic novel?
Absolutely. Yeah, Meal is going to be a graphic novel for young adults and up, and it's basically that classic story of the young woman who moves to a new town, makes new friends, sparks a romance, and she's seeking a job at this exciting new restaurant that specializes in insect cuisine. So it's this sort of young woman's journey to greatness in her extremely specific field of interest.
You said the intended audience for the graphic novel is young adults. Why young adults, not young children?
There is definitely I feel like there's a lot to explore with this subject. With the particular genre of comics I'm hoping to make an homage to with this story, it's something that young adults are already quite familiar with in the comics they consume. Japanese comics, which lots of people know as manga, they have a lot of stories that feature food narratives and people kind of having adventures exploring, you know, unusual foods. And I found that while I was, you know, evoking this genre of comics, which I enjoy very much, it led itself to this sort of idealistic story of a younger person, you know, learning more about this field they're interested in, you know, meeting the eccentric people along the way who share their interest and, you know, educate her and help her, you know, become a more skilled, well-rounded expert in her field. And there's ways to do that in a really, you know, funny way, because this is in some ways an extremely ludicrous topic, but it's something that I think would be really interesting to young adults as well as adults, and more, most of all, to make it accessible and easy to understand for anyone who's kind of developing a interest in food preparation, where our food comes from, you know, how you deliver that to the people that you share your life with and that you share food with. I found that it was very easily generated towards younger adults. But I definitely think that there are opportunities to broaden the subject with children as well in the future.
So is the goal of this project, this graphic novel, about education or perception of eating, cooking insects?
I would say so. I would say it would be the idea of normalizing it as, you know, a new experience, a new hobby, a new interest for people to see as viable and not just like this strange or foreign or other thing. And I found that comics are extremely good at making the, you know, the foreign or unusual accessible and easy to understand.
In Meal, do you address the social and cultural, any social and cultural stereotypes that we hold in Western culture?
I do. And that's why I really want to make this more accessible, because I, as a, you know, a white American person, should not be the only person discussing these subjects. Because really, insect cuisine is a marginalized section of already extremely marginalized food cultures. When you think about, you know, how Asian American children, or, you know, Mexican American children, for example, when they are growing up and trying to consolidate their experience with food and their home with the typical American idea of lunches, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know, dinner is spaghetti and never the twain shall meet. That's a really difficult experience. So while I'm trying to discuss that in the book, I feel like that's why it's important to at least make this subject approachable in books, in comics, in TV, and in everything, in news, so that other voices who maybe, you know, grew up with this or have family who, you know, have done this, to share their stories and to, you know, just broaden the experiences and what's being spoken about it.
What do you think about travel shows? I'm thinking like Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. You know, every commercial you see or I've seen for that show, it's, you know, Andrew's eating a, you know, some sort of insect in South Asia. What do you think those travel shows do for stereotypes? Do you find that, do you think it's like educational and helpful, or is it reinforcing otherness in food?
That's a great question. And it's interesting that you bring up Andrew Zimmern, because he's from Minnesota as well. He's kind of a beloved local figure. To his credit, I think he does a good job with the medium he uses to make those foods accessible and to present them as part of a cultural whole. Like, he treats them with sincerity and, and compassion in his reporting, you know, as I've seen it. I feel like there is a disconnect between when we choose to listen to those stories more. It's interesting that he always gets brought up for articles around Halloween time, because that's when you get all of the, here's the most delicious spooky foods you can eat this Halloween. And, you know, that's where that break happens between people who are knowledge and, you know, very sympathetic in their reporting. And there's that divide between that and the mainstream. And I feel like until we reach that event horizon of this is a, like sushi, like the thing that I kind of talk about when explaining my goals are, think of The Breakfast Club, that scene where they're all eating lunch and Molly Ringwald's character pulls out her sushi lunch and nobody knows what it is. And that was filmed in what, 1985, something like that. And now suddenly you can get sushi back home in Minneapolis. I feel like we are at, in American society, we're at that cusp of making insect cuisine not just hip and cool, but also like, oh, it's something that anyone can do, anyone can consume, and it would be a great deal more sustainable than sushi in a lot of parts of America.
Mm. Oh, yeah. And we do think that if Western cultures were to accept it, that would make it better for the rest of the world as well. There would be less of this effect as Western culture comes into these other places of making people feel uncomfortable eating foods that they've always eaten.
Precisely.
In Mexico, they're having trouble with chapulines and escamoles, people getting made fun of at school for eating foods that have always been part of their culture because
people
it's not what you see on TV.
Yeah, mm-hmm. People see them as ant eggs and grasshoppers, and it's difficult to convey that properly as, you know, these delicious regional cuisines that people have eaten since conquistador times.
Mm. So if we could get rid of our taboo, it would open up these foods again for people. And a lot of times they are the most local, sustainable foods.
Chelsea Thomas and Blue Deliquanti, thank you so much for talking with us about the art and science of cooking with insects.
Thank you, Erin.
It's been a pleasure.